Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/curd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comte-usa.com. That's comte-usa.com.
All right. Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd. We are here today with Jesse Pukash, a sake distributor and founder of Fifth Taste, based out in San Francisco. Jesse, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, man. I am psyched for this. I've never had a tasting episode, and I am so glad to finally get this off with sake. I think it's sort of just being tapped into, especially through you. So I am so happy to share this with the audience today. So thank you for coming on the show.
Of course. It's great to be here. And I'm so honored to be your first tasting episode. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So how did you get into the sake biz, or how did you start into spirits, if I can even call it spirits at first?
So sake, technically not a spirit. It's kind of its own category. And I'll kind of work my way through that through our tasting today. But I actually got my start working in sake about 16 years ago. At that time, I had just moved to San Francisco, 23 years old, looking for work bartending. And a friend of mine who was moving out of town and giving up her shifts, she suggested I go by the place where she was working and talk to the person who ran the show. The place is called Ozumo. It's a Japanese restaurant down on the Embarcadero. And at the time, in the early to mid-2000s, Ozumo was sort of a mecca for sake. It still is, but back then, you know, aside from a couple places in New York, it had probably had the largest and most diverse sake program in the country. I walked in there not knowing anything at all about sake or Japanese cuisine. I had never had sake in my life, had only had sushi, you know, maybe twice. Somehow talked my way into a job bartending lunch shifts, bar backing at night, kind of learning the ropes a bit. And after about a year, you know, really kind of got into sake working there and had worked my way into some prime shifts behind the bar and eventually took over the beverage program and with that curation of their incredibly diverse sake program. So then for about 3 years, I ran the program at Ozumo, oversaw all the sakes on the list and all the sake education for new staff, and just kind of fell into being a sake guy. Just kind of woke up one day and said that this is what I'm doing. And after about 4 years working there, I had burned out on that side of the industry and took a job with an importer, learning a bit about that side of the business. Did that for about 3 or 4 years, and then took a job as the sake specialist for a large national wholesaler called Southern Wine and Spirits. Some of the listeners may have heard of that place before, running their sake portfolio in Northern California. I did that for about 7 years, but, you know, honestly, during my time there, I never felt fully comfortable working for the man. So mm-hmm. when I left, the dream was always to start my own thing. And then in the middle of last year, I opened Fifth Taste. And my company operates throughout California as a wholesaler distributor dedicated solely to artisanal sake. And I'm also an educator for the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, WSET. And, you know, starting this company was my way of expressing my love for artisanal, family-owned, sometimes a little geeky sake breweries and, you know, connecting their passion for the craft with American consumers.
I mean, and I love that you are going for like the different sake, something a little bit, not your usual first round of sake, something a little bit more underground, which I'm excited for our tasting later in the program to kind of get to. My question to you is, when you first started in sake, did the language barrier ever stop you? How did you break through that first, like when you were learning about sake, what were like the first things that you felt yourself overcoming?
So the language barrier is one of the more difficult things that I think really kind of keeps people away from sake a little bit and can be a bit intimidating because, you know, you pick up a bottle of sake and, you know, there's all these strange words, even if they're written out in English. So that can be a little bit confusing. So yeah, when you first kind of get into it, it's a little bit much. I did, you know, pick up a little bit of Japanese and study a little bit of Japanese throughout my career working with sake. But yeah, it, especially at the beginning, it can be a little bit overwhelming when you're starting to explore sake and trying not to be intimidated by a lot of these, you know, Japanese phrases and terms and concepts. I think the industry is slowly starting to kind of move in a direction that makes sake appeal to people without kind of leaning on those, you know, some of those Japanese words and terminology, but yeah, it can be a little bit difficult for sure.
Well, and I think we, in our pre-chat, we sort of discussed how the bottles that you have actually do a great job of having some English names and suggesting how to serve the sake. Like I had no idea before that some are chilled, some are room temp. I don't know if you want to speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, there are no hard and fast rules for sake in terms of, you know, temperature and things like that. Obviously there are some guidelines, but yeah, I think that bottles, when they are imported into the United States, if they have a screen name, you know, if like the ones that we're tasting, there's one called Forest Spirit, there's one called Sublime Beauty, you know, you'll find things out there called Wandering Poet and things like that, which I think do a great job of helping people connect to it a bit. And then to your point about descriptions and back labels and, you know, suggestions, things like that, I've always found that the really kind of well-developed importers in the U.S., not just the folks that I work with, but other folks, you can really kind of tell who they are based on their labels. You know, if the label has good information about the flavor profile and, you know, ideas for pairing and serving temperature, those are people who really care about sake and how it's presented.
And in terms of Fifth Taste, the name of your mm-hmm. company, what, why Fifth Taste?
Fifth Taste is a reference to umami, which is known as the fifth taste that our tongues perceive along with sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. And a lot of what I enjoy doing is starting a conversation around the unique presence of umami in sake and how that relates to enhancing the enjoyment of our food, which obviously has brought us here today to talk about sake and cheese. Not everything that I work with and not everything that I champion is, you know, super high umami sake. But a lot of what I really gravitate towards personally are sakes with a bit more of that umami and complexity, because there's just such a wide variety of things that you can do with it pairing with food.
So it's sort of synonymous then, and it can be in high end, it can be light to heavy, you're saying. And does that mean the body of the sake can also be lighter or heavier? I mean, I'm going a little bit ahead maybe, but.
No. And I think, well, you know, obviously when we taste through these sakes today, you know, it'll kind of demonstrate itself a bit more. But yeah, there's a whole kind of wide array of different kind of styles of sake, some with a bit, you know, more umami, some with a bit less. Maybe it'd be helpful if I kind of back up a little bit and give like a little bit of a background on sake and kind of how it's made, what goes into it. Maybe that'll help.
Yeah, let's break it down. Yeah, let's do that. Let's break down like the basic, like, how sake is made and start with that? Because otherwise we'll get ahead and everyone will be like, what are we talking about? So let's go into the basic one-on-one here.
All right. So let's lay a little groundwork. So sake is an alcoholic beverage made from rice. It's not a rice wine, as some people call it. It's actually its own unique category. There are some parallels to wine, but the production process is actually closer to beer, but still completely unique from other alcoholic beverages. So rice. So grain of rice. What is a grain of rice? A grain of rice is made up of proteins, fats, minerals, and starch. And sake rice that's grown for sake is a little bit different than rice that you would eat. With types of rice that you eat, those elements that I mentioned, the proteins, fats, minerals, and starch, they're all kind of scattered throughout the grain. For rice that's used to make sake, they typically will use strains where they're able to grow a very well-defined starchy center with the proteins and fats confined to the outer regions of that grain. I like to visualize a sake rice grain like a hard-boiled egg. So you have that well-defined yolk in the center, that's the starch, and the egg white on the outside, that's all the other stuff. So what they do is, using a rice milling machine, they polish away the outside layers to get closer to that pure starch center. And the general idea is that the more of that outside layer is polished away, the softer, the cleaner, the more elegant the sake will be. So now that we've milled down that rice, because it's alcohol, it needs yeast. But we're not quite ready to add yeast because the starch that's left behind is not fermentable the way it is. So expanding just a little bit more on starch, a starch molecule is basically a tightly wound chain of glucose molecules, or basically sugar. And in order for the yeast to be able to access those sugars to convert them into alcohol and CO2, we need something to break down those complex starches into simple fermentable sugars. So enter our dear friend koji. Koji is a mold that's used throughout Asian food and beverage production in things like shochu, soy sauce, miso. In sake, it is sprinkled, this mold spore is sprinkled onto steamed rice before brewing. And what happens is that mold produces enzymes. Those enzymes act like scissors. They penetrate into that grain of rice and cut up those glucose chains and make the within that starch and free them up to get consumed by the yeast. So koji enzymes go in there, break it up. That way the yeast can access those sugars and convert them into alcohol. At the same time, the mold is also producing other enzymes that go to work on the protein bonds in that rice. So the protein bonds, which are basically amino acids, they won't ferment, but when they're broken apart, they leave behind amino acids, which can contribute to the flavor of the sake. And those acids, in particular aminos like succinic acid, glutamic acid, those are the building blocks of umami. And sake has, on average, about 10 times the amino acids as wine or beer. And kind of just jumping back for a second, if you know we were talking about milling, if you only mill the rice a little bit, you'll have more of that protein left in the grain of rice, and thus typically more amino acids left behind. So you'll have kind of bigger, richer, fuller, heavier sake. If you mill it more and get closer to that center, so you know most of what you're leaving behind is starch, you won't have as much of those amino acids and other impurities that are not fermentable in those outside layers. So the sake will be more floral, more elegant, delicate. And then, you know, obviously, as we kind of taste through these, that'll kind of come back a little bit more because we'll talk about the milling and stuff like that. So for the koji, they will typically propagate that mold onto about 25% of all of the rice that's used in making the batch of sake, because that's all that they need in order to generate the enzymes to sacrifice all of that starch. And then the process of sacrification, so starches turning into sugar, and then fermentation, then turning those sugar into alcohol, all that happens at the same time in the same tank, which is pretty much completely unique to sake. It's called multiple parallel fermentation.
Whoa. Okay.
So that's wow. So yeah, it's all.
I'm just trying to absorb all that. No, no, it's good.
I know.
It's great. I love it. It's super sciencey, but it's definitely the great groundwork that we needed to know. Okay, sorry. Continue.
Oh, okay. Well, so I was just going to kind of transition a little bit to how that all plays in with sake and cheese. There are some advantages that kind of gives sake relative to wine. So through that process, the acidity in sake is much lower than wine. So it makes it a lot much rounder on the palate as opposed to kind of sharp and acidic. So it's a little bit more forgiving when it comes to pairing. It doesn't contain sulfites or tannins. So, you know, if you've ever tried to pair highly tannic wines with certain types of cheese, it just doesn't work. It's just horribly bitter and just not workable. Sake also, a lot of them has a pretty pretty present appeal of lactic acid, so which can lead to some cool complementary flavors. And then, as I mentioned before, you know, that presence of umami in sakes with a bit more of that amino acid. You know, adding umami through beverage pairings is kind of like the way you add umami in kind of within food itself. Like if you're, I don't know, if you're making like bolognese and, you know, you have that rich, fatty meat high in umami with tomatoes that are high in umami, you know, just a delicious meat sauce on its own. But then you take that meat sauce and you shave on some Parmesan. And it absolutely just ignites the flavor of that dish of the bolognese. So sake and cheese together, when it all works in perfect harmony, it kind of does the same thing of really intensifying the flavors and making something really unique.
Okay. So I have a follow-up question to that. Is it okay to cook? Is it okay to cook with sake, or is that like a terrible thing to do?
It is definitely okay to cook with sake. I think that a lot of times when you cook with sake, if it's a particularly, you know, elegant, clean, soft sake that, you know, would a lot of times be more expensive, it's kind of a waste. So you can basically go and get inexpensive sake, not too sweet, not too floral or fruity, just something that has that nice kind of rich sake flavor. And use it as a substitution for cooking with wine. Absolutely. I do it all the time.
Okay, cool. Cause I was in my mind, I was like, wait, sake is too precious to cook with. Maybe this is a terrible idea, but you have just cleared up that myth. So you can cook with sake. Okay. Excellent. I
Absolutely.
Love that. Okay. And then how did you discover cheese in your life? Because now you're able to pair sake and cheese, but, how did that happen for you?
Yeah, so my wife Liza, who you know, who works for Sweet
I was gonna
Grass
say
Dairy.
I'm playing dumb a little bit here, but I love Liza. She's incredible. One of my favorite people. So anyway, go on. Yes.
So back in 2012, 2013, somewhere around there, she made a career switch and started working in cheese, and she started bringing home all these super cool cheeses. I had all these cool sakes. Our fridge was getting a little bit crowded, so we decided to start doing some pairings, ended up having some friends over for these little sake and cheese parties and just really enjoyed the two together. And actually, back then, we started a sake and cheese blog, but I don't think we've updated it in like 6 years.
Okay,
I mean, every year we renew the domain and say we're going to revive it, but maybe now's the time.
What's the name of it, may I ask? Did it have a clever name?
Oddly enough, yeah, it's super clever. It's sakeandcheese.com.
Oh, beautiful. I'm glad glad I asked.
Or
okay.
Actually, I think it works both ways, actually, cheese and sake or sake and cheese. But yeah, long overdue for a bit of an overhaul. But we've done sake and cheese classes at a bunch of different cheese shops. And actually, I think it was 2018 at ACS in Pittsburgh. We were on a panel together with a couple of friends of ours that was partly focused on talking about sake and cheese and doing some pairings. And, you know, the reception from cheese people through this little sake and cheese journey has been great. I've really enjoyed making that connection. And within the sake community, you know, we're always trying to find ways to broaden the appeal of sake. So, you know, a lot of prominent, influential people in the sake world, you know, people in sales and promotion and some sake brewers have been on the sake and cheese train for a while and have done some really fantastic work enlightening folks to the wonders of cheese and sake.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So I wonder then, can a cheese shop in the United States purchase, can they sell sake? Is it fall under beer licensing or is it fall under wine licensing?
So sake falls under, so typically in most states, wine and beer is the same license. It's definitely that way in California. It's that way in New York, Texas, Florida. There may be a couple of styles of sake, if there's added alcohol, that might change the taxation a little bit. But typically any cheese shop that is licensed to sell wine or beer is absolutely licensed to sell sake. And I definitely think that they should.
Okay. Yeah. Because based in New York, just what I know is wine is separate and beer is its own thing. So in a supermarket in New York, you can have beer and cheese sold, but you can't have wine always. So it's like a separate. But this is why I asked you, because I was like, wait, maybe if I open a cheese shop in New York, I can sell sake and cider and stuff like that and beer. So that's why I was curious. And alcohol percentage wise, what's the ratio in sake generally?
So typically sake that you'll buy will be around 15 or 16%. Sake will actually naturally ferment a lot higher than wine. It'll ferment up to around 18 or 20%. Typically, I'd say 90, 95% of the time, they will dilute that sake to bring it down to around 15 to 16%. But in some cases, and we actually have two of them, I think that we're tasting today, that are not diluted. So those are up in that kind of 17 to 18 range. But typically, a sake will be, 15 to 16% alcohol. So a little bit higher than wine.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. And in terms of selling them around the United States right now, you're generally selling to, restaurants when they're open after this time that we're all having, or
yeah.
is it retail? A lot of retail. What do you sell more to, restaurants, food service, or is it more retail sided for you?
So I sell more to restaurants. For the types of sakes that I sell, they kind of just work really well in that format where, you may have a sake som or someone in there, kind of help guide that guest experience. There are some great sake shops and retail places around the country that I can talk about at the end if you'd like, just give people some suggestions. But I do some retail work, but for me personally, it's mostly restaurant, which is actually kind of the opposite of the world that I had come from working with Southern. That was mostly retail. So it all kind of depends on where you're at in terms of the portfolio that you have. But for me personally, it's mostly restaurant. So we're waiting for things to return to normal.
Yes, yes, yes. I know what you mean. Okay. Well, I am excited to get this tasting on. What I want to do is just take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to start the tasting. So just listeners, hang on for a quick sec and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its Order Hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/curd.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Conte within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Conte. Conte takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineur on average, each wheel of Conte is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Conte is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Conte is unique. Learn more about Conte, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at conte-usa.com. That's conte-usa.com.
All right, and welcome back to Cutting the Curd. Today I have Jesse Pukash of Fifth Taste, a sake distributor based in San Francisco. And we are just about to jump into this amazing tasting that he has sourced and put together. Jesse is based, like I said, on the West Coast, and I am based on the East Coast. So during these times, we source cheese from kind of our coasts. So it was very fun to do the tasting and sort of have the same style of cheese, but then talk back and forth about the little differences and then go over the sake. One of my favorite things that we just did last week. So, Jesse, would you like to discuss our first pairing?
Sure. So the first sake that we are going to enjoy is called Heiwa Kid Junmai Daiginjo. So this sake is from an area in Japan called Wakayama, and it is made by a really exciting, amazing group of young brewers. That's part of the reason they call it Kid. Jumping back for a second, when we were talking about milling and how much of that rice they're milling away before brewing, this is a Junmai Daiginjo, which means that it's that kind of highest classification of milling. So they've milled away at least 50% of that rice grain to qualify as a Daiginjo. So, you know, typically with a Daiginjo, you'll expect to get those, you know, bright, floral, fruity, elegant notes in the sake you know, obviously we'll lead to some fun things with certain cheese pairings.
Okay. And in terms of color, I'm seeing it's a crystal clear color. So that means it has been filtered. Am I saying, is that wrong or right? You can correct me right
now.
Yeah.
So there are a couple things with the filtration. So when some people say a sake has been filtered or unfiltered, it's a reference to what's called nigori sake. I think some listeners may have had that or heard of it. Nigori is that kind of cloudy, milky appearance of sake, and that comes from roughly pressing the sake when it's done. You basically separate the solids from the clear liquid. So when they roughly press the sake, you get that kind of textural, cloudy rice lees in the sake. The other thing they'll do, even if they press it fully, there'll be like a little bit of haze to it. So most sake is then charcoal filtered. So sake is like this, where it's pretty much crystal clear. They have not only, you know, pressed it fully, but they've also charcoal filtered it to, you know, remove any of that residual haze or color. So crystal clear, pristine, beautiful.
Okay. And this one, I have it chilled. And then in terms of tasting sake as with cheese, what is your recommendation?
What are you drinking out of, by the way? What kind of glass?
That's a great question. So I have one of these beer glasses that's like a few ounces. I hope I didn't mess that up, but it's one of those tasting beer glasses that's kind of bulbous. You tell me.
That's great.
I didn't even ask about glassware.
that's great. That's, you know, a lot of times people ask about glassware. I am a fan of anything that lets the sake express itself. I'm drinking out of stemless wine glasses or tumblers. Wine glasses are perfect 9 times out of 10. You know, if you're drinking a sake without a lot of aroma, you don't really need it. You can drink out of a smaller cup. But I'm a huge fan of, you know, utilizing the glassware aspect of the wine industry for enjoying sake. So, and then, you know, what you're using, those bulbous, you know, beer tasting glasses, great. As long as you can focus the aroma and really kind of get the impression of the sake, perfect.
Great. And then from what when we first did the tasting, you take a sip first of the sake, then a bite of cheese, and then another sip of sake. Is that the best way to do a cheese and sake tasting?
Yeah, I like to kind of make a little cheese sandwich in there with the sake. So go, you know, sake, one piece and then butter cheese and then cleanse it with the sake again.
And then, okay, so if I was to be in Japan and I was about to say cheers, what's the word again for saying cheers?
You would say kampai.
Kampai. Okay, all right, I'm going to take a kampai. Okay, I'm going to take a quick sip right now, and we'll talk about, and then we'll take the bite of cheese and so forth. Let's see.
Mm-hmm. So when you taste it, you should be getting a lot of those bright, fruity notes. I get strawberry and cotton candy, bubblegum. Really light-bodied, super
wow.
clean.
Yeah, I definitely get the cotton candy, strawberry notes. Okay, I'm going to take a bite of, I have from Blue Ledge Creamery in Vermont, a Camembert, which is a bloomy-rinded, soft-ripened cheese. So I'm going to take a bite of that, and I believe you have the Greenhill from Sweetgrass.
I do. I have the Sweetgrass Greenhill. So similar in style, if I'm not mistaken, to what you're eating. But yeah, really, really nice and buttery.
Yeah, I'm going to take another sip now. Yeah, this definitely has like the strawberry, like strawberries and cream cake effect going on right now, which mm-hmm. is so cool. I mean, as the first of four, I think this it has that sweetness going on that is nice and biting. Almost, it doesn't have the fizz of a champagne, but that sort of effervescent feeling to it that is a perfect first pairing to it.
Yeah, and I think as far as the spectrum of sake goes, this is on the low side when it comes to umami. So, pairing that with a cheese that's relatively mild and a cheese that doesn't have tons and tons of umami, it's actually a nice complementary pairing. Yeah, I actually like this sake a lot also with blues, because you get that sort of, or maybe not this sake specifically, but sakes with, more of that kind of like orchard fruit profile, apples and pear, things like that. I think, pairing that style of aromatic, bright sake like this does really well with those kinds of cheeses also.
Definitely. I can imagine that because the traditional cheese pairings of like pear or sauterne with a blue cheese, this kind of gets in that lane. So I completely agree. That's very cool. Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. We have to go on to our next pairing. It's so hard to leave the first one. I just want to keep drinking more.
well, we can always come back. So
yeah, that's the fun of this. All right. So yeah. The next one, would you like to introduce it? Well, I'll let you introduce it. You say the names better than I do.
Sure. I've been doing this a little while. So the second one is called Soma no Tengu, or Forest Spirit. It's from Shiga Prefecture in Japan. And this is what's called a Moroka Namagenshu. It is not charcoal filtered. It is not pasteurized and it is not diluted. A bunch of the things that I work with are in that vein of non-charcoal filtration, dilution, or pasteurization. It's essentially after the sake is fermented, they press it and it is bottled and enjoyed naturally the way it is. So, they won't undergo those other steps to kind of smooth out the edges and sort of tame the sake. So it's very wild, very expressive, really assertive, lots of acid, lots of umami. And then one thing you'll probably notice with this, it's got a little bit of a haze to it.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. I love so, you look through the light, it just glows. It's amazing.
Yeah. So it's what's called an usu nigori. So I mentioned briefly about nigori before, that quote unquote unfiltered, actually more of a roughly pressed sake. Typically they'll be a lot more opaque than this. Usu nigori just means it's a very thin nigori. So you get that little slight haze to it from a very, very rough pressing.
So that's the style, usu nigori. Okay. Yep. Excellent. All right. So I am going to take a sip in a moment, and I am pairing this with a fresh chev, also from Blue Ledge Creamery, from Vermont. And on your side, you have, I believe, Laura Chanel Fresh Chev?
I have Laura Chanel Fresh Chev, and this was actually the first creamery that Liza worked for. So this is kind of a bit nostalgic for me from days when we would have tons and tons of this delicious Laura Chanel Chev in the house.
Oh, man. I'm jealous of your fridge.
We at a had to buy a whole separate full-size fridge because we were just getting completely taken over by sake and cheese.
Oh my God, the life, the lifestyle. I love it. Okay, all right.
Tough work, man.
Kapow. All right, I'm going to take a sip. Totally different fruit elements going on right now. It's not as sweet, so it's more umami. I'm going to take a bite of the cheese now.
Yeah, the sake on its own kind of has this like candied mushroom quality to it. You know, it's got that really cool fungal umaminess, but a bit sweet, a bit slightly creamy, but super cool and nutty and toasty and just a delicious brew.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just getting like the most beautiful toasted bread notes right now, because you have that like sort of yeastiness from the goat cheese, and then it just sort of rounds out beautifully with the forest spirit. I just feel like I need to be outside now and like and enjoying life with this, you know.
Yeah, I think for Chev, when you know, I've done a couple different pairings with this. I think sake is like the first one we did, the Heiwa Kid. I actually really like those bright, fruity sakes with, you know, really clean, fresh Chev. But then getting into slightly more textural sakes, creamier sakes like this Usunogori or even a Nigori Nigori, I think that those texturally do really well with the texture of a Chev.
Yeah, it just elevates it. It brings those features of the goat cheese, which is normally just a straightforward fresh goat cheese, and gives it another level to it, which I think to me for pairings means we did very well when you have something that's enhanced on both sides. Actually, it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, having that umami backbone in the sake and those really, you know, hugely apparent aminos in there really enhances that flavor of the cheese. That's great.
And I just to the listeners, dear listeners, the top of this bottle is so interesting. It's like a little, it's like a cork. It's not a screw top. It has like a very ingenious way of preserving itself. And correct me, Jesse, you said bottles can be kept for up to 2 to 3 weeks after you open them. Is that what we talked about before?
There actually is no time limit. I think what you'll notice with sake is like the first one, the kid, the Jumai Daiginjo. If you have a Jumai Daiginjo, something that's, you know, aromatic and fruity and floral, you'll see those components of it start to fade a bit after about 2 weeks. The sake won't get bad, but those really lovely fruit notes will start to fade out a little bit. Sakes that have a bit more depth and acidity and umami, those a lot of times even get better with age, even when they're open. I have bottles in my fridge that have been open for 6 months and they taste amazing. There's kind of like a life cycle to open bottles of sake. Sometimes it, you know, is not great and those notes will fade a little bit. But, you know, long story short, just because you've had a bottle that's been open for a month, I would say, one, drink your sake faster, please. But also, it didn't go bad. It doesn't turn into vinegar the way that wine would. It doesn't, you know, really deteriorate the way that beer does. I would say, you know, if it's something that you really like, save yourself a little bit, hide it from yourself in the back of the fridge and come back to it in a month and see what you think.
I mean, I doubt I'll need that much time, like you said, but I just for anyone who maybe is taking a glass a night or something, you know, they might want to just have that time zone. So, okay, very cool. Thank you. We go third bottle here.
All right.
So we have, it's in English, it's Sublime Beauty, but I'm going to throw it to you now for the full name.
All right. So, it's called Tainohana, or Sublime Beauty, from a brewer called Moriki Shuzo in Mie Prefecture, which is kind of close to Wakayama, which was the first brewery that we tasted, right kind of in the middle part of Japan. An incredibly famous, amazingly cool brewery. The brewer, Rumiko Moriki, is a bit of a legend in the sake world. She's actually the first ever female master brewer and brewery president in the sake industry. Sake brewing is very much still a man's game. I think that I'm going to guess and say less than 5% of all sake brewers are women. And Rumiko being the first female master brewer kind of was a bit of a trailblazer. There are a handful of female master brewers now, but she was just, she's an absolutely legendary character in the sake world. She's known now because she grows a lot of her own organic rice. She mostly uses ambient yeast. So a very funky, interesting style of sake making. This sake in particular, the Sublime Beauty, is a free run sake. It's called Arabashiri, which is basically before they press, they take the mash, put it into these mesh canvas bags, and they lay it down for pressing. But before they actually apply any pressure to those bags, the sake that can kind of run out on its own, that's free run sake. So really kind of, you know, youthful and brash and exciting. Also Morocco Nam against you, like the sake that we just tasted. So high alcohol, high acid, a bit more umami. And then lastly, and then we can get to tasting in a second, the thing I really like about the sake is the milling rate is 90%, which means they've only removed the outer 10% of that rice grain. So there's so much left in that rice grain before they start brewing. So you get, you know, a lot more rice forward characteristics, a lot more umami, a lot more savoriness and depth and complexity. And this is, personally, I would say this is my number one cheese sake of everything that I work with.
And, oh, wow, I forgot that. This is, okay, your favorite. Excellent to know. And you have met this brewer before? You've met her in real life?
Yeah, I've actually been fortunate to meet, I think, pretty much all of the brewers that I am fortunate to sell their sake. I was actually with her in February. I was in Japan, and I was visiting with her, you know, before the world got turned upside down. Mm-hmm. And she's a big fan of pairing her sake with cheese. And actually, when I was with her, we were tasting through her sakes, and she served me a flatbread made out of sake kasu, which is basically the leftover sake lees that get pressed into almost like a cake from the pressing process. So she used that as like a flatbread, melted some cheddar on top of that, and then added anchovies.
Whoa.
So it's like umami on top of umami on top of umami. And then we did this, and it was like, you know, fireworks in your brain. It was just insane.
That sounds like heaven, because I'm addicted to umami savory. As a cheese lover, oh my God. I want to meet this woman. I'm going to go to Japan, and I'm going to meet her.
We had been talking a little bit about trying to get her over here for some events or something. Then obviously everything got all crazy. But she's incredible. She's hysterical, an inspiration. I love her. Her sakes are incredible.
That's so cool. And this is Nama, so it means unpasteurized, as you mentioned.
Unpasteurized. So yes. I realize we're kind of throwing a lot of terms at the listeners, but Nama, anytime you see that on a label, that means it's not been pasteurized. So on the positive side, you get, you know, a lot more expressiveness and brightness. The only downside is that a lot of times it can spoil a little bit because those enzymes are still active. So when you do talk about, you know, going back to your question about how long to keep a bottle open, you have to be a little bit careful with unpasteurized sake because those can turn pretty sour and get a little bit spoiled. This one in particular, because it is not diluted and not charcoal filtered, the acids are high enough that this one is a bit different than most unpasteurized sake. It can stand up for months.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So let's do this. Let's take a sip. And even I the bouquet is a little stronger. Sort of like the, I think maybe rice notes, I want to say, that I'm starting to smell, or like a sugar slight note, caramelized note to it. And then I'm going to take a bite of the cheese. The cheese that I have is from Blue Ledge again, and it's a goat's milk cheese with a bloomy rind. Its name is Cortina. And on your side, I'll introduce it. It's the Serve et Belle Boucheron. So let's go for it. So right away, the playfulness between is it's a very like almost sort of very salty goat cheese, aged goat cheese. And then because the sake has sort of a minerality that can like bounce together with it, you almost feel like you're like in the cellar, sort of getting the like the aged goat cheese out of the cellar is where my mind starts to go, because you're just getting this kind of slightly tart sweetness, and then the minerality is what. So it's just like this whole playful vision in my head of goat cheese being made and drinking sake.
Yeah, it has this really cool rustic feel to it. And, you know, one of the things I like about doing with this cheese in particular is you get that little textural difference, you know, between the middle part of the cheese and then getting closer to the cream line. It changes the component a little bit and how it plays with the sake. So there's some kind of, you know, different ways you can play with this pairing too. Yeah, this
and the sake is delicious. Yeah, I was just going to say, and it's delicious. I wonder, I have a question for you, an etiquette question.
Sure.
If I wanted to add an ice cube to the sake, is that a terrible thing to do?
It is. It's not a terrible. It's not a terrible thing to do if you like it. Whatever you want to do to your sake that helps you enjoy it, do it. I would say that if you were to add an ice cube to the first sake that we tasted, that would get way too watery, way too, you know, thin and light, because it's, you know, generally a light sake. This sake is built like a tank. Like I said, you know, 90% milling rate. So it's, you know, lots of rice, lots of structure and body and alcohol. This is something where if you want to kind of rein it in a little bit, sure, you could add an ice cube. I would say that most brewers in Japan would probably thumb their nose at that a bit, because they want their sake enjoyed exactly how it is brewed.
Totally fair.
But also, you know, it's also fair to drink things that you enjoy. And if, you know, it's a little too dense and a little bit too, you know, intense, sure, you know, cool it down a little bit, you thin it out a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, no, or you just throw it back in the fridge again.
There you go.
Very, very cool. No, I love this sake. It's excellent. All right, we have to move on to our fourth pairing, the very last pairing of our session.
All right.
Yes. So, okay. You so can the last, say it. Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah,
all
go
right.
for it.
So the last sake that we're going to do is from a brewer called Manzai Raku in Ishikawa. So we're now on the west coast of Japan, on the Sea of Japan side, kind of in the middle. You know, Japan's kind of shaped like a banana. So this is kind of like right on the inside of the curve of the banana. It's actually from an area called Hakusan within Ishikawa. And actually, if you look at the bottle that you have in the bottom right, there should be a little GI stamp on it.
Oh, yeah.
So a GI Hakusan. This is actually the first area in Japan to get a geographic indication for sake making. So, yeah, really cool brewery. Grows all of their own local rice. It is a Yamahai Junmai. We didn't talk about Yamahai before, but I'll just kind of touch on that a little bit. Yamahai and a cousin of Yamahai called Kimoto, which applies to the sake we just tasted, those are more of a kind of an old school way of making the yeast starter. So basically, you know, after they've made their koji, you know, milled the rice, made the koji, done all that, they need to make a yeast starter. So they take a little bit of koji, a little bit of steamed rice, a little bit of water, and then all the yeast. And the idea is to propagate enough yeast cells to sustain fermentation for the duration of the process. But at the very beginning, the yeast hasn't started fermentation, so there's no CO2. So they need to basically preserve that yeast starter from harmful bacteria. And the way that brewers do that is by adding pure lactic acid at the beginning. But before they had that technology of adding lactic acid, they had to develop those natural lactic bacteria naturally. And there are two old school methods of doing that, which are sort of similar to each other. I like to call them cousins. I won't get into the differences between the two, but basically these two old school methods, which are more time consuming, more laborious, but they naturally develop lactic bacteria to protect the yeast starter. One of them is called Kimoto and the other is called Yamahai. nowadays, I would say the vast majority of yeast starters are made in the modern method where they're adding lactic acid because it cuts the time in half. It's a little bit more stable. But some brewers that really want that cool, rustic, old school style, they will still use those Kimoto and Yamahai methods to make their yeast starter.
And we began the conversation about this bottle hinting at, I guess, terroir, which I did not ask you about before. In terms of Japan and making these sakes, does it matter what part of the country it's being made in? Is there a temperature or climate difference with the rice? I'm not even sure where to begin on this.
I was actually coming into this hoping you would not ask me about regionality and terroir.
No,
it opens a whole Pandora's box of discussion about it. It's a question I get all the time. What I'll say is, yes, it does, and also no, it doesn't. There are a whole bunch of things that contribute to terroir and regionality in sake. The water that they're using, the local, you know, water sources and the minerality in the water will have a lot to do with it. The type of food that they eat historically will have a lot to do with it. The rice to a certain degree. But I would say that the regionality in sake and terroir in sake is something that is widely discussed and seldom agreed upon within the world of sake. That's what I'll say.
So maybe it's more about the brewer and the craftsperson than anything else.
That is 100% what I will sort of stick to. I think that I've had someone say to me with wine, 80% of the character of the wine is due to the fruit and the terroir, and 20% is due to the skill of the winemaker. Sake is the exact opposite. So, you know, maybe 20% of that character of that sake is due to, you know, the rice and the raw materials. 80% is focused on, who's actually doing the making. I actually had, one of my first sake teachers would just sort of drill into my head, stop worrying about where this is from and start worrying about who's actually making it, because that's really what's important.
That's really cool. I love it because so much of the personality then of each brewer is based in these bottles. And I think that's super cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go for the fourth pairing. Here we go. I'm going to take a sip. Get like a clean, heavy umami flavor going on.
Yeah, a lot of kind of like brown butter, brown sugar, a little bit of mushroom. So typically when you come across those Yamahais or Kimotos, they will have a bit more of that umami to them for sure.
Cool. And I am going to taste it with, again, from Blue Ledge Creamery. And this is the Middlebury Blue. So it's a cow's milk blue. And on your side, you have Sweetgrass Dairy's Asher Blue, also cow's milk.
Indeed. Lovely Asher Blue.
So this is more of a drier blue, kind of funky, earthy, not creamy at all. And it has like a buttery popcorn note at the end. Yeah. And I'm going to take another sip of sake with that. Oh, man. Again, under heaveness. Like, that's not even a word. I just made up a word because this is so...
We can make heaviness a word. Let's do it.
Heaviness is a word now?
It is. It's we good. Just decided.
It's a good session. It's a good happy hour session here on Cutting the Curd. Man, the tartness of the blue, like that kind of moldy, kind of bready notes that you get that then go with this sake. I love, again, the balance that they're both sort of on the heavy side, but they can, they don't overpower each other. They really kind of still dance well together.
Yeah, and I get this like really nice like toasted butterscotch thing going on my end. It's so nice and unique, and that's not something that I was pulling out of the cheese on its own. But to me, once you kind of add that sake and those flavors interacted, you really kind of brought up another third flavor that I had not yet found in the cheese.
It's very cool. I mean, I think normally in our pre-discussions, this was aligned to more natural rind cave-age cheeses. But then because that moldy nature of the cheese, it goes so well with this type of sake that the blue cheese actually really kicks into gear very, very well with this. So bravo on this pairing. This is great. I was just going to say it has like that burnt wood flavor. I have that in my notes from before, and I'm just starting, it lingers into that, which it's kind of, you get the, like a forest wood fire type feeling. But anyway, so what were you going to say, Jesse? I'm sorry.
Well, no. So what I was going to say is that I think for, you know, obviously we don't have any washed rind cheeses with us for this pairing, but getting into these, you know, slightly funkier, earthier styles really opens up some amazing pairings, you know, getting into washed rind and more funky styles of cheese. Just because, yeah, again, I mean, having that really interesting depth and complexity in the sake can really add a lot to these funkier cheeses.
Oh yeah, I could see a washed rind going along with this. We totally like didn't have that style in here on this group, but oh yeah, that could be fabulous. And it doesn't have like, sometimes I think there can be like a metallic clash with some red wines. So this actually, because sake is so good at being delicate and subtle, but still amazingly delicious. It has so many nuances that that I've never enjoyed before, which is very special, I think, to sake. And I'm glad you're like speaking about this to everyone so that they can learn more, because I never knew anything about sake before, and this is just so cool to sort of hear all the differences between, like, I'll look at a sake menu now and definitely look to for the words in the title. And understand, like, okay, this is going to be like this or that, which is, I think, we have to keep encouraging that.
Of course. And, like, I would encourage people just to be a bit more adventurous and experimental with sake. You know, obviously, we don't have time to do it on air, but, you know, if we were to go back through and taste all of these sakes with all of these cheeses, you'll find that so many of them, you know, create interesting pairings, and sake is so forgiving and amenable to food across the board that, you know, it's really just such a nice thing to incorporate into your daily drinking life and your pairing activity. So it's, yeah, I'm really glad we're able to do it like this.
So if somebody is just starting to learn about sake, I wanted to ask you, what is the best book or website or Instagram to go check out to learn more about sake?
So in terms of a website, there are a handful of good websites and good sources of information online. I would say if I were to direct people to kind of one hub, there is a website called Sake World. I think it's sake-world.com. It's run by a guy named John Gauntner, who is sort of the most well-known sake evangelist in the world. He English speaking sake evangelist in the world. He is based both between the US and Japan. So his website is a great resource. And then also he has a couple books that I think you can access through the website. That's a great place to start. But you know, really the best exploration from sake comes from drinking, just going out and you know, buying sake and trying it with cheese and
which leads me to my next favorite question is, where do we buy these sakes?
Okay, so these sakes in particular, a bit scattered, and these are all, you know, small production sakes, so it's not like you can just go to Whole Foods or, you know, Safeway and pick them up. But what I actually think that the best thing to do is just kind of, you know, generally direct people where to get sake, and I think most of these sakes will be available in these places. For me, we're super lucky in the Bay Area. We have possibly the best sake store on the planet called True Sake. Then in Oakland, there's an incredible sake, Japanese spirit kitchenware, barware shop called Umami Mart. They're incredible and they have some incredible sake. In New York, you guys have an unbelievable sake scene. There's a place called Sakaya in the East Village that's great. Kodaichi and Duke's, those have great sake selections there in Brooklyn. For folks not in any of those places, if looking for, you know, e-commerce, I would say the best e-commerce sake hub would be a place called Tipsy Sake, T-I-P-P-S-Y. They have a really interesting thing going on. But the other thing I want to say is that it, kind of to recommend to people to drink local sake. The domestic craft sake movement has really reached a whole nother level in the last few years with amazing sakes being made by Den and Sequoia, both in the Bay Area. Let's see what else. Brooklyn Kura in your neck of the woods is absolutely amazing. Wonderful people making great sake. I feel bad I'm leaving out so many great sake makers.
No. This is news to me. So you're saying, I just want to make sure I'm clear about this.
Yeah. Yes.
So people are making sake in the United States? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea.
I would say going back 30 years, people started making sake in the U.S., actually 40 years now, more kind of like large scale, inexpensive supermarket brands. Like if you were to go into, Kroger, I don't know what supermarkets you have where you are, but, the mainstream supermarkets, the sakes that you'll find for, $7.99, $8.99, those are typically made in very, very large scale breweries in California. The Gekkokan, Shochigobai, who all make really good sake, but obviously large scale production. People started making craft sake in the U.S. probably about 20 years ago, and some of it good, some of it not so great. But really in the last 5 years or so, the domestic sake world has kind of reached a whole nother level with the craft scene. So like I said, Den is incredible, Sequoia, Brooklyn Kura. I think actually there's sake breweries in about 20 states right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I personally, I don't distribute any domestic sake. I strictly do imports. That's not to say I wouldn't ever do domestic sake, but I don't distribute any of these. But honestly, for consumers, I think forming that connection with locally produced food and beverage can really help form a deeper bond with the craft. So please support your local sake maker. I'm sure you can just Google, local sake brewery or whatever and find something where you are. But there are, I think about 20 states have wow. breweries now. It's incredible. Huh.
I had no idea. Oh, okay. Okay. So
who knew?
Well,
who knew?
Thank you for sharing all of your sake wisdom with us on this episode. I feel like you just gave everyone the gateway pass to the sake world, and we're all going to just go out and buy more sake right now. Which is super cool. I mean, I'm so excited once I can get out of my apartment to to just go over into a sake store and browse those shelves now. I'm like, oh man, I have like a whole new world to check out. This is effing great. This is so cool.
Awesome. That's so nice to hear.
Yeah, no, this was a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're definitely going to give you a shout out on all our social medias at Cutting the Curd. For you, it's at Fifth Taste. So people, please follow at Fifth Taste. And I just want to say thank you for coming on the show, Jesse. This was great.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
All right, guys. We'll be back next week, but I hope everyone stays safe and is good out there and, supporting what they can in these times. This week, HRN will be donating 10% of its membership drive and the proceeds to the Philando Castile Relief Foundation. This is to support families who've lost loved ones to police brutality and help enact police reform. This is based out of St. Paul, Minnesota. So, again, if you want to help donate and, give a little change to the world, heritageradionetwork.org/donate, that would be great. Again, HRN will be donating 10% of the membership drive to the Philando Castile Relief Foundation. I hope everyone has a great week and, stay strong, be safe.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.